This is 5 o'clock shadow on the Pacifica Radio Network, originating at WBAI. In today's Juneteenth special edition of 5 o'clock shadow, we will be taking a look at the Silent March in New York City of 2012, as well as the history of the first major Silent March in New York City in 1917. We'll be speaking with the Criminal Justice Director of the NAACP, which initiated the 1917 March. We'll also be joined by the former Director of the William Moses Kunstler Fund for Racial Justice, Randy Credico. We'll also be looking into the East St. Louis riots that precipitated the 1917 March, as well as the history of Juneteenth and the continuing racial profiling of black youth in the state of Texas, in particular, the town of Tulia. I'm Robert Knight in New York. This is 5 o'clock shadow on the Pacific Radio Network, originating at WBAI. I'm Robert Knight in New York, and over this past weekend, there was a very special event in New York City, the Silent March to End Stop and Frisk, or as we prefer to call it, Stalk and Frisk, a policy that targets black and Latino youth in New York City, and there are similar programs across the country. And on the occasion of this second major silent march, which gathered on the order of some 20,000 people marching down Fifth Avenue to the mayor's residence, we note that this weekend's event gathered about as many people as in 1917 at the first silent march initiated by the NAACP. We are therefore quite pleased to have with us Niaz Khosravi, the Criminal Justice Director of the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People. Welcome to 5 o'clock shadow.
Thank you so much for having me.
Tell me about the significance of what the NAACP did in the past and what Benjamin Jealous, your national leader, and others took part in on Sunday.
Yes, absolutely. Racial profiling has been a problem that's plagued the African-American community and other communities of color throughout history. And there was a lot of momentum that built up prior to 9/11 to actually begin to dismantle it and get rid of racial profiling and implement effective policing measures that serve to bring community and police together to work on resolving violence and strengthening their relationships to together promote public safety. However, the events of 9/11 drastically changed the public mentality about whether it was okay to target people based on their race or nationality or religion or any other immutable characteristics. So unfortunately, the types of profiling that we've seen throughout history continued, and at the same time, a number of new communities began to be targeted in the name of national security post 9/11. And it really put a stop to a lot of the momentum that had been building really for centuries. You know, you mentioned that the silent march that took place in 1917, and that's sort of why we decided to sort of replicate that, because I think that the Trayvon Martin shooting really made the nation realize that the issue of racial profiling has a devastating impact beyond the fact that it's humiliating and it criminalizes communities of color en masse. It can lead to violence and death and loss for these communities. And so I think to show the gravity of this problem, we used the same tactic as were used last century to really bring attention and put a stop to the violence with the lynchings that targeted African-American communities. And so we kicked off sort of a renewed commitment and campaign to end racial profiling over this weekend. It's a national campaign, but, you know, I mean, for the reasons that I mentioned, because we feel that not since before 9/11 has the country been so tuned in and engaged around the issue of racial profiling. We really need to make sure we leverage this momentum and not only pursue justice in the case of Trayvon Martin for his family, but also use it as a means to pursue justice for communities of color throughout the country. So this was really the kickoff to that campaign. And because stop and frisk in New York is such an egregious violation, it is probably the most clear example of officially sanctioned racial profiling. And there are so many just outrageous numbers that have come out recently with regards to how many people are being stopped and the fact that it is not working and it is criminalizing youth of color for the most part, gave us a reason to come to New York and kick off this campaign there to put a stop to this abusive practice.
One of the hallmarks of the 2012 Silent March is the wideness of the participation. It was organized by silentmarchnyc.org mm-hmm. under the lead direction of Leslie Kagan, but involved some 300 organizations, including yourself. And significantly for some, it built a bridge between communities of color and the LGBT communities, who also joined in and have also been the target of police aggressive tactics. What do you make of the widening of the spectrum of protest over this issue?
I think it's absolutely, absolutely fantastic. In fact, one of the first emails that I got right after the march from a colleague was actually to that effect. And she said, you know, I didn't know how this was going to turn out. I knew you guys were trying to lift something really huge, but this was probably, and she's an organizer and has been doing this for her whole life. And she said, this is probably the most diverse march that I've been a part of. And she was very proud to be a part of it. And I think that's the only way that we really are going to get anywhere with this issue and most civil rights issues, right? We can't just stand up for something that's right for certain groups of people and ignore it when it happens to others. And I think that there was a realization that our community has come to, as was apparent by the participants of the march. And you're right, the conveners of the march, you know, we had National Action Network, NAACP, we had the SEIU, NYCLU, we had CPR, and over, you know, we almost 300 endorsers of this march who joined us on that day. And it was, I think it was a beautiful thing to see so many people from so many different backgrounds and so many different walks of life come together and say, this is not okay with us.
The NAACP has a very bold history with the Legal Defense and Education Fund and litigation on behalf of civil rights across the country for the benefit of many different groups of people. Are you involved in any litigation in regard to this kind of policing, this aggressive kind of racial profiling?
So I work for the criminal justice program, and we are the advocacy and research arm of the association. So our team isn't particularly involved with litigation right now. However, the fight does continue in all arenas, including in the courts. And that would be probably a question that would be best put to somebody at the Legal Defense and Education Fund to see what types of lawsuits they may be involved in and they may be considering. But that's absolutely a tactic that's necessary. I mean, this issue has to be attacked on all fronts, right? We have to create public awareness and knowledge about not only the numbers and the fact that they show that this hasn't really made us any safer, and also the fact that this reaps devastation in our communities, but also attacked from the policy front and the legislative front and the courts. So I think until we attack it on all, once we attack it on all fronts, we have the most chance of being successful. But I think that we have taken a great step towards ending this practice by the solidarity that was shown over the weekend.
Well, I'd like to thank you so much for being with us today on this significant Juneteenth of 2012. Dr. Niaz Khosravi, the Director of Criminal Justice for the NAACP, how can people be in touch and follow your work?
They can go to our website and call the national office. And number one, I think for everybody who always asks me how they can be involved, I ask them whether they're a member of their local branch. So I think the first thing you can do is contact your local branch and become a member. And you can find all the information about the work that we are doing, that the National is doing, on our website. But I know that our state and local branches take on many different issues throughout the spectrum. So I would really encourage folks to contact their local branch and become active.
Well, thank you so much, Dr. Niaz Khosravi, the Director of Criminal Justice of the NAACP, the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People. This is 5 O'Clock Shadow. I'm Robert Knight in New York. And we now go to the former director of the William Moses Kunstler Fund for Racial Justice, Randy Credico, who was also at the march where in 1917, the people of Harlem marched in their Sunday best. But Randy, I understand you made a political fashion statement in your participation in the silent march.
Hi, Robert. Yes, I did. I wore a chain gang, Southern chain gang prison suit, horizontal stripes and a striped hat with a sign that read, "This is how Bloomberg and Kelly view black and Latino youth."
We know that you have been long involved in racial justice and the criminal procedure system that targets disproportionately people of color. And in particular, you were among the arrestees many months ago of a stop, stop and frisk protest, along with Dr. Cornel West and dozens of others. How do you see this movement growing, and what is your perspective of it today?
Well, I was really excited encouraged by the large turnout on Sunday. We were arrested way back October 21st, and I think that put a real spark in this movement with Dr. West and Carl Dix and a group called Stop Mass Incarceration Network. And we were arrested on three separate occasions. They gave us a five-day trial. We were all convicted, and which gave us more publicity. That on the heels of the CCR's brilliant a legal strategy through the federal courts, in which they now have a class action suit, I think has just sparked this huge, huge movement that we got to continue the momentum, the organizing, the activity, and not slacken off a bit, because this is going to be a tough fight. We are going against a mayor and Ray Kelly, who it's like trying to bring in Moby Dick, you know, with a fishing pole. So it's going to be a lot of work ahead of us.
Well, in regard to this procedure that some people call stop and frisk, I call it stalk and frisk.
I agree with that.
The police internally refer to it as SQ and F, stop, question, and frisk. Final question for you, Randy. The mayor has been finding any black church with open arms to defend the process and say that it needs merely to be mended. That is to say, Mayor Michael Bloomberg is pretty much calling for offense mending. Do you think that politically, that there might be compromises to be attempted?
I think that the mayor will do that. He's got a big purse. He's well-connected through his political consultants with some of the leaders out there. I mean, you do have those like Reverend Flake, who you know, is very open to satisfying the mayor. We just have to ignore that and continue on. This is a long, long, long struggle. It's not just stop and frisk. That's not going to stop what's happening right now, Robert. So make this final point. Look at the police that they have. They have hired, it's almost like Somoza's National Guard, where he went out into the country and brought in, you know, scary people to repress people in Managua, or Cossacks that the Tsars used. You know, the same, or the French kings used the Swiss Guard. That's what we have right now. It's got so many tentacles. The policing in New York City, stop and frisk is just one of the pimples. There are many more aspects of this that have got to be challenged. Not reform. No, there's no, you cannot reform slavery. You cannot reform convict leasing. You've got to get rid of it. It is a cancer, and we cannot settle for half measures here.
Well, thank you so much for being with us, Randy Credico, and we'll stay in touch as this situation develops.
Thank you, Robert.
This is 5 O'Clock Shadow on the Pacifica Radio Network.
Is it possible to say how many stop and frisks were conducted this year and how integral that was to the crime stats?
Give that number on a quarterly basis to the city council. I believe it's close. It won't be finalized. It takes us about a month to tabulate the final number. So I can't give you the 2011 number.
Oh, and I'm sorry. And just as a follow-up, can you say how important it was to fighting or reducing crime?
I think if you look at all of our strategies, you look at the Operation Impact, you look at the real-time crime cycle, look at the use of technology, look at the policy of engagement, it all worked. You don't have the reduction of crime when you have a 6,000 fewer police officers unless you're proactive and look across the board at our strategies and you look at the results.
Oh, mama, I'm in fear for my life from the law. The law.
Stop and frisk. The police, yeah, I said it. Let them come in, Larry Davis style, bust them. Eye for an eye, leave everyone blind. But I'm tired of losing mine. Another child dies, another child beat by the cop who walked the beat. But we'll rest so he can meet his quota for the week. These days, can't walk the streets without the jakes. When I run up and search you for your pockets and murk you, that's criminal. The system accuses you with the same crimes they do to you and call it excusable. Sean Bell's killers acquitted. Troy Davis, Lindstedt, Mumia still in prison. I don't get it. In the land of the free, why you think young Curry guns carry guns? We've been taught violence since day one. So if they want peace in the streets, they can start with justice for the team and the family of Ramon.
Oh, mama, I'm in fear for my life from the law.
Stop, come on.
Yo, murder is murder and assault is assault. Time to shut the city down, bring business to a halt. Illegal searches, you ain't never had a warrant. The streets is on fire, don't consider this a warning. This a promise from the land full of promise. But APA give us office after office to assault us. 13 years after Amadou, they still killing us. What you gon' do? Where you gon' run to when they run in your house? And they pull the guns out, one shot take you out. The biggest gang is the NYPD, and Mayor Bloomberg is they dirty as heck. They stop and frisk, fill the jails with kids. Let's keep it 100, man, we tired of this. They guilty of murder, guilty of assault. Get a special prosecutor, man, prosecute them all. Oh, mama, I'm in fear for my life from the law.
Stop and frisk.
I seen a kid get beat riding a kick style. Kicked him with hatred, called him a thief cause his skin's brown. Are we less human? We niggas are spicks now. Has the mayor been stopped the frisk down in his town? They beat you there and locked you up in the crease bell. Many stories about abuse, power the streets tell. Bullets rain hell on black males from 2012. It's target practice preparing for another Sean Bell. Ray Kelly be calling up the officers to tell them officers.
I search niggas to bring quarters in.
8 times I've been stopped for no reason. An unarmed kid was murdered, burned all the priests. The badge is worth more than the life of a human being. No justice, it's just us fighting for our freedom. Instead we're asked for IDs, giving severe beatings. I pray for the better, but the police killed Jesus. Oh mama, I'm in fear for my life from the law.
Stop and frisk, yeah.
Stop and frisk, and we won't stop.
Rebel Diaz from the RDACBX, the Rebel Diaz Arts Center of the Bronx with G1 and colleagues. Stop, and frisk. This is 5 o'clock shadow on the Pacific Radio Network. I'm Robert Knight in New York. And in the aftermath of the successful silent march against stop and frisk in New York City on this past weekend in the year 2012, we note that the first major silent march took place on the 28th of July, 1917, also co-arranged by the NAACP. And it came at a time when President Woodrow Wilson was questioning the legitimacy of the rights of people of color in the midst of the period of World War I. And this, amid his silence in regard to the rampant lynchings and murders of African Americans throughout the United States, from Texas to Missouri, where in East St. Louis there was a particularly egregious incident that formed the basis for the first silent march and many other subsequent actions. And we go now to the scene of that crime in East St. Louis, where public station KETC, in their series Living St. Louis, gives us a documentary history of why that first silent march occurred after the travesties that took place in East St. Louis.
East St. Louis back then was an industrial boom town with all kinds of conflicts and tensions between ethnic and political groups, between workers, companies, unions, but there were plenty of jobs. When World War I cut off the flow of immigrants from Eastern Europe, companies went to the American South for a fresh supply of cheap, unskilled labor. And now these northern industrial cities had a new issue to deal with, something they called the Negro problem. Like the Eastern Europeans before them, African Americans now left home to find work and to start new lives in northern industrial cities. And they heard that if you couldn't get a job in East St. Louis, you couldn't get a job anywhere. There had always been African Americans living in the American bottoms, but their numbers were relatively small until now. You could see it every day at the East St. Louis train station, the new arrivals from the South coming in such numbers that they were becoming more visible in town, in the factories, and in politics. These were loyal Lincoln Republicans anxious to vote, and Republican Party leaders were anxious to get them registered.
It upsets the political balance in the first couple of decades, especially in that second decade. And there's lots of talk, especially in the teens, about voter fraud.
The charges came from the Democrats, and during Woodrow Wilson's 1916 re-election campaign, the Justice Department investigated what was being called colonization, an alleged conspiracy to import blacks to steal elections in northern cities. One story, unsupported by evidence but widely circulated, was a plot to have blacks vote in East St. Louis, then board a train to vote in Springfield, and a third time in Chicago.
If you take the newspapers at face value, you would say the public perception was, oh yes, there was colonization. But when you start digging through the testimonies, people knew it wasn't that at all. Black folks were trickling into the city. World War I opened the floodgates. They were coming anyway for jobs, and the contemporaries knew that.
But people were being told they were here to steal elections. Labor leaders said they were here to steal jobs. And the huge numbers of newcomers were straining the local housing and services. Racial tensions continued to grow. It's not that the country was ever really at peace with itself in this era. There were race riots and labor battles like these in other cities before and after. But what happened in East St. Louis struck a national nerve. The reports of Americans killing Americans came on the same front pages as the reports of American troops in Europe fighting to save democracy. It was labor troubles at the aluminum ore plant that set the tragic events in motion. The company followed its usual practice of bringing in replacement workers to break the strikes and keep the plant in operation. But now many of the replacements were Negroes. There were white replacements too, but strike leaders made blacks the issue and the target.
It becomes so conflated with racial animosity, too. It's the way that you can organize people and organize a mob. That's what they did.
In the spring of 1917, the National Guard was brought in to protect the factory and its workers. But everybody knew this was a town on the verge of a race riot. When violence flared up in May, the Guard was able to keep it under control. But East St. Louis hadn't cooled off. Tensions built, fueled by unsubstantiated press reports of Negro crime waves and gun purchases, and by rumors and inflammatory public speeches.
They wanted to drive the blacks out of East St. Louis. They wanted to make East St. Louis an all-white town.
The evening of Sunday, July 1st, a car drove through a Negro neighborhood firing shots as it drove by. Later, when another car approached, shots were fired from the crowd. Maybe some thought it was the same car, but it wasn't. Police officers were in this one, and two were killed. When word of what happened spread, white mobs set out to attack blacks. They beat, shot, lynched, even burned to death. Fires were set in black neighborhoods and people were shot as they tried to escape the flames. A family just up from Mississippi stepped right into the middle of it.
And we just as we got to 10th Street, where we were standing, we could see different people running and hollering, colored people. And they were getting down in the weeds that they were hiding from. And the guy would run and shoot. You didn't know what to shoot. You just see the smoke and hear the shot.
That was a scary time.
The daughter of former Mayor Melbourne Stevens was told to stay indoors, and she watched from her bedroom window.
You could hear cars racing by and people yelling and screaming, and I could see all the fires burning. Where they'd set fire, you know, to the colored houses. I was petrified.
No one will ever know for sure how many people were killed in the East St. Louis race riot of 1917. Some of the early reports were exaggerated. The official death toll was 39 blacks and 9 whites. Others accepted the higher number of 100, almost all black. They searched for bodies, but so many people couldn't be accounted for. Maybe they had crossed the bridge to St. Louis. Maybe their bodies were somewhere in the river. The nation responded with speeches, editorials, and accusations. Some blamed labor, the police, city government, industry for importing blacks. Some said whites had only acted to prevent a black uprising. In the South, many said the race riot exposed Northern hypocrisy and showed what was really awaiting Southern blacks in Northern cities.
By the 19-teens, it was the North's turn to decide on the Negro question. And I see East St. Louis as a harbinger of white supremacy, Northern style.
Despite pressures from blacks and whites to condemn the riot, President Wilson made no statement. But Congress investigated the riot, the crimes, and the city of East St. Louis itself. This wasn't a black eye. This was a self-inflicted wound that would leave an ugly scar if it ever healed at all.
Living St. Louis from the public station in St. Louis, Missouri, KETC. This is 5 O'Clock Shadow on the Pacifica Radio Network. I'm Robert Knight in New York. And yes, you did hear correctly. At the early years of the 20th century, the roles of the Democratic and Republican parties were reversed. And at that time, coming out of the 19th century, Negroes were holding a greater affinity with the Republican Party than the Democrats. Although that has flipped in recent times, the underlying issues remain pretty much the same. The riots that took place in East St. Louis were not the only ones across the country. Another major provocation that led to the first 1917 silent march in New York City were the rampant lynchings that were taking place in Texas, in particular in the town of Waco. And Texas has a very sordid history in regard to the post-slavery times, because that is why this is called Juneteenth. It was 2 years after the Emancipation Proclamation that the slaves of African American heritage in Texas were allowed to be known that they had been emancipated. And the history of that part of Texas' role was addressed by our sibling station, Pacifica Station KPFT, in Houston, Texas, where we now have this origin of the tradition of Juneteenth in the United States.
Juneteenth commemorates the announcement of the abolition of slavery in Texas. Today it is celebrated around the world. On June 19, 1865, Union General Gordon Granger and 2,000 federal troops landed on Galveston Island, Texas, to take control of the state and to uphold the freedoms of newly liberated slaves. Slavery to this point had continued in Texas even after the end of the Civil War. Texas' acceptance to the United States in 1846, in fact, was a controversial issue. Speaking in Belfast, Ireland, Frederick Douglass delivered an impassioned speech on the matter of Texas' admittance to the Union. I have the names of several persons who took part in the settlement of Texas, but the territory was chiefly settled by the citizens of the United States, of the slaveholding states of America. It was early seen by them that this would be a delightful spot to curse with slavery. They accordingly took their families and slaves to Texas, from the blighted and blasted fields of Virginia, fields once fertile as any under heaven, and which would have still remained so had they not been cursed by the infernal spirit of slavery. We do not hear much of confusion in Texas until 1828 or 1829. When Mexico, after having erected herself into a separate government and declared herself free with a consistency which puts to the blush the boasted lands of freedom, proclaimed the deliverance of every captive on her soil. Unlike the boasted Republic of America, she did this at an immense cost to her own slaveholders. Not proclaiming liberty with her lips while she fastened chains on the slave, not securing liberty for her own children, but also for the degraded bondsmen of Africa, this act of the Mexican government was resisted at once by the settlers who had carried their slaves into Texas. Though they were bound by a solemn agreement to submit to the laws of Mexico, they remonstrated with the government. They said their slaves were too ignorant and degraded to be emancipated. The Mexican government, desirous to treat amicably with those whom it had welcomed to its bosom, listened to this remonstrance and consented that the Texian slaves should be only gradually emancipated under a system of indentured apprenticeship. Even this restriction was evaded by the Texians, making the indentures binding for 99 years. In fact, they showed themselves to be a set of swindlers. Well, Mexico attempted an enforcement of her law, making it impossible for any man to hold an apprentice for more than 10 years. This was resisted on the plea that the slaves would not be fit for freedom even then. One would think that 10 years long enough to teach them the value of liberty, but these wise Americans could not understand how that could be the case. The man who goes into your ship on the high seas, puts out the captain, takes down the ensign, and declares himself the owner is no greater robber than the people of the United States. And what are their excuses? Their apologies? Their reasons? For they always give reasons for what they do. One of them is that Mexico is unable to defend her territory, and that therefore they have a right to take it. What do you think of a great heavy-fisted fellow pouncing on every little man he meets, and giving as his reason that the little man is unable to take care of himself? We don't see this as pretext made use of in the case of Canada. Mexico, nevertheless, is a sister republic which has taken that of the United States for a model. But Mexico is a weak government, and that is the reason America falls on her. The British territories are safe because England is strong. The cry of slavery is ever, give, give, give. That cry is heard from New England to Virginia. It goes on, leaving a blighted soil behind, leaving the fields which it found fertile and luxuriant covered with stunted pines. From Virginia, it has gone to North Carolina, and from that to South Carolina, leaving ruin in its train. And now it seizes on the fertile regions of Texas, where it had been previously abolished by a people whom we are wont to call semi-civilized. They say they only want to increase their commerce and add to their security. Oh, what a reason to give for plunder. The pirate of the high seas might have the same excuse. Stephen F. Austin's attempts to negotiate a solution resulted in the persistence of slavery in Texas for years to come. The Emancipation Proclamation came into effect on January 1, 1863, but it wasn't until July of 1865 when an estimated 4 million slaves held in Confederate states were freed. In Texas, slavery continued until the march of Union forces into Galveston. General Granger stood on the balcony of Ashton Villa and read what would become known as General Order No. 3. People of Texas are informed that, in accordance with a proclamation from the Executive of the United States, all slaves are free. This involves an absolute equality of personal rights and rights of property between the former masters and slaves, and the connection heretofore existing between them becomes that between employer and hired labor. The freedmen are advised to remain at their present homes and work for wages. They are informed that they will not be allowed to collect at military posts, and they will not be supported in idleness, either there or elsewhere. The day that would become known as Juneteenth was cause for celebration. In many parts of Texas, according to the Texas State Library and Archives Commission, ex-slaves purchased land for Juneteenth events. For example, Emancipation Park in Houston was opened in 1872. Juneteenth celebrations went dormant in many cities in the 1950s and 60s, but were rekindled in the 1970s. Today, Juneteenth is recognized by many U.S. states as an official holiday. Concerts, teach-ins, picnics, and events around the United States and the rest of the world remember the sacrifices of African slaves and the vision of freedom embodied in Juneteenth.
Turn me around, well, turn me around, well, turn me around, ain't gonna let nobody, Lordy, turn me around, well, keep on a-walking, keep on a-talking, marching up to freedom land.
For Pacifica, I'm David Dorrell. Stations like this one depend on your support to continue broadcasting educational, cultural, and other diverse programming like this. If you're not already a member, please consider contacting the station to join today.
And this is 5 o'clock Shadow on the Pacifica Radio Network. I'm Robert Knight in New York, and the consideration of the current racial profiling of Black and Latino youth in New York City indicates that policing does not achieve its stated goals when it is applied in a racially discriminatory way. As our colleague Hugh Hamilton stated with great precision and eloquence the other day, the stop and frisk policy was at about 100,000 incidents that were recorded in the year 2002 when Mayor Michael Bloomberg, the vigorous defender of the process, came into office. There were about 97,000 stops and frisks and about 1,800 or 1,900 gunshots throughout the city. The mayor claims that the reason for enforcing the stop and frisk regime is to find guns and stop shootings. Well, last year, when the mayor multiplied by seven times to nearly 700,000 stop and frisks of primarily Black and Latino youth, the number of shootings recorded in New York City was the same number. In other words, there is no measurable statistical difference in the stated reason for the identification, intimidation, questioning, and entrapment of these youths of color. There are other police procedures that remain to be directed against people of color in the United States. As we note on this Juneteenth, nearly a century and a half after the lynchings in Waco and the massacre in East St. Louis and rampant incidents of violence against people of color throughout the country, there was a new twist. Instead of guns, the drug wars of the United States were disproportionately applied to people of color. For instance, with President Bill Clinton's defiance of the Federal Sentencing Commission and supporting the discrepancy between the use of crack cocaine that at the time was believed to be more prevalent in communities of color and of powdered sniffing cocaine. As a result, there was a 10-to-1 sentencing burden that fell upon people of color using essentially the same drug. And nowhere was that discrimination more evident in recent times than yet another Texas town, not Waco, but in the town of Tulia, Texas, where there was a runaway racially selective prosecution in which nearly 1/3 of the black male population of Tulia, Texas, was arrested on a fraudulent drug charge that was put forward by a perjurious operative of the sheriff's department there named Tom Coleman. He was on what would later be revealed as a crack scholarship himself in the use of those drugs and the falsification of arrest records for the black people who were targeted there. During that roundup, the evidence did not include money, illegal drugs, paraphernalia, or weapons among the black youth who were arrested in Tulia. And we were there at one of the major rallies against the Tulia enforcement against people of color of fraudulent drug charges.
I think the sheriffs and the police officers who surround us believe in what they are doing just as much as we do. This is a battle for the heart and the minds. And we are involved in a debate. We are not adversaries. We are brothers and we are sisters trying to find our way through difficult issues and difficult times. We have gathered because we believe a great injustice has been perpetrated. And we will continue to speak out because it is our right as Americans to say what we believe without embarrassment or fear.
Here in the darkness, in front of City Hall, candles, lighters, flashlights are being lit, bringing a new brightness to this Tulia night, where 46 people were indicted, convicted, or accepted plea bargains, tantamount to guilty, because of a runaway drug sting operation, spearheaded by one Tom Coleman, using extraordinarily unorthodox and undocumented methods, his word held up in court against those he targeted after being given a list of alleged drug participants by the local sheriff.
To me, they was targeted at all blacks. I mean, and all young blacks, really. And, you know, I mean, it ain't like we dumb. We knew these the police. He just say, can I get some crack? And he a white man that we don't know. I mean, it ain't like we was dumb. But a lot of my homeboys was arrested. And when they came to jail, they told me about it. I mean, and all they could say is, man, we couldn't put no clothes on, man. They had us out in boxes. The TV news was already there. And then my girl write me a letter when I'm in jail and tell me that the housing authority and already sent them eviction notice. I mean, it was like it was all one day. I mean, how would everything go that fast if they didn't have it planned? I mean, they wouldn't even let people put their clothes on, and they walking on TV news and boxes, hair messed up, no shirt, no shoes, no socks. I mean, you should have seen how that made them feel. I mean, that's just like taking your manhood.
When friends by shame are undefiled, how can I keep from singing?
Amen.
Yeah.
Reverend Doctor, we're here at the stroke of midnight in Tulia, Texas, walking from the public park to the downtown area, periodically crossing corners with patrol cars, police, sheriffs, highway patrol, and so on. What do you think is the historic significance of this moment?
Well, I think the historic significance is that it puts us in relationship to the liberation and freedom struggle that's been going on in this country and around the world for the last half century. It's important that we are lifting up many of the same issues in terms of human rights and freedom. It's important that we see the continuity between the civil rights struggle of the 60s and where we are now. I think that one of the ways in which those things that were gained and the progress that was made has been eroded is by the way in which the war on drugs has come and been a part of the way in which we've seen, you know, just the systematic, you know, deterioration of rights and personal freedom. So I think it's real important that we think of this moment not in isolation, but rather we think of it in the context of being a part of a much bigger struggle that's been going on for human rights and for justice and for freedom for a long time. The fact that the problem has been responded to purely in punitive terms instead of being responded to in ways that talk about education and prevention and addressing the real systemic problems that are at the heart of the problem. The fact is that people who are disenfranchised and people who number amongst the dispossessed are people who always are most vulnerable. And once again, that's manifest itself. So I think it's important for us to speak up, speak out.
Do you believe that the drug war and the communities targeted is just a new way of reinforcing Jim Crow?
Oh, clearly it's the new Jim Crow. I mean, all you have to do is look at the numbers and look at the way in which it has directly impacted the lives, especially of African Americans. I don't see how you could deny interpreting it that way.
And finally, is the war on drugs historically analogous in any way to what you have spoken of, Martin Luther King's declarations on the Vietnam War? Is there a change in leadership and consciousness taking place? Is there a comparison to be made?
I think there's a definite comparison to be made because it challenges the posture of this particular system in a way that I'm convinced causes folks to have to deal with the fact that what has happened is that the war on drugs has turned out to be a way in which people are profiteering and taking advantage of the of a position of disadvantage for others. I mean, if you look at the whole prison industrial complex, the way in which it's grown and the way in which it ends up being fueled by this, you know, so-called war on drugs, then you find yourself realizing that this is something that ultimately is being, that people are profiting from. Folks are, you know, they've come to have, you know, financial self-interest in perpetuating this war the way it is. It's not doing anything to end the war. You look at the number of prison beds that are being built, this whole pattern of mandatory sentencing that we have seen does nothing but continue to fuel that system. I call it the new black gold. It's like blind mining in the black community and taking people and incarcerating them. And they're making money off of it.
You've spoken also of the union among people of color and people who are whites. Is that significant tonight?
Oh, I think it's very significant. When you look at this group, it's not just one people. It's all people. They're Hispanics, they're Europeans, they're people of African ancestry, they're Native Americans. We're all here. We all recognize the fact that we're being victimized by this war and that we have to speak in one voice if we're going to end it.
In downtown Tulia, Texas, I'm Robert Knight. Thank you.
God bless you. Good to see you. Christ is important.
I do believe that he shall turn out.
My goodness.
And that concludes today's special Juneteenth edition of 5 O'Clock Shadow, with thanks to Randy Credico, the William Moses Kunstler Fund for Racial Justice, Mothers of the Disappeared. Thanks also to Niaz Khosravi, the Criminal Justice Director of the NAACP, KETC, KPFT, and you, the listener. We welcome your comments and suggestions with an email to theshadow@wbai.org. With production by Thiago Barroso and engineering by Michael G. Haskins, I'm Robert Knight for 5 O'Clock Shadow.